Engineers from around the world are putting some very new cars through final tests here in the U.S. They're competing for an award from the XPRIZE Foundation, which offers millions of dollars to spur advances in technology. These cars are ultra-fuel-efficient vehicles designed to get at least 100 miles a gallon. Most of them are electric or hybrid two-seaters, but Sandy Houseman of member station WVTF reports on one unusual entry, a four-seater built in Lynchburg, Virginia, that runs on old-fashioned gas.
Lynchburg is an old river town with a population of fewer than 75,000 people. It's not the kind of place you'd expect to produce a 21st century car, but entrepreneur Oliver Kuttner thought it was perfect. Warehouse space was cheap, so Kuttner, a retired race car driver, hired a team of winners from the world of racing and set up shop. 25-year-old Brad Jaeger is his director of research and development.
With racing, it's all about pushing performance to the absolute limit. With the other automakers, they've become so stuck because the cars that they're producing next year rely on parts that were used this year and the year before.
But Lynchburg had plenty of good machine tooling shops to make new, super light parts for the car Kuttner wanted to build.
Once you make every part light and you end up with a light car, you need much less power. So you have a smaller engine. When you have a smaller engine, you can have smaller brakes, etc., etc.
The finished product weighs just over 700 pounds, far less than a typical compact car, and unlike most other entries in the XPRIZE competition, it's not an electric or a hybrid. After crunching the numbers, the team, called Edison 2, decided batteries to run the car were not worth the extra weight. So the very light car operates on a mix of ethanol and gasoline. It looks like the cockpit of a small jet, silver and black, with wheels protruding about a foot from the body. Inside, says Chief of Design Ron Mathis, it's pretty basic.
This car has no soundproofing whatsoever inside it, so it's going to be noisy.
To improve aerodynamics, the car has no door handles or side view mirrors, relying instead on buttons and cameras. Light, sleek, and low to the ground, it can go from 0 to 60 in 7 seconds.
It's so light that it just feels alive in your hands. It's fun.
But how could a car like this survive on the highway alongside trucks and SUVs? Oliver Kuttner says the very light car meets all U.S. safety requirements and incorporates many features of race cars.
We've all seen the video footages of cars hitting walls at 160 miles an hour, partially falling apart, and then the guy getting out and saying, "This was a bad day," and scratching his head.
Kuttner says electric cars are not ideal because of their limited range, and both electrics and hybrids are saddled with heavy, expensive batteries that can fail in 5 to 7 years. Instead, he thinks super light cars are the way to fuel efficiency. At Automotive News, editor Jason Stein says the industry is already moving in that direction.
We're seeing that the size of vehicles is obviously decreasing from what it was even 5 years ago.
But with Americans getting fatter, Stein doubts small, light cars will grab a big share of the market anytime soon. The Edison 2 car must undergo another round of track and laboratory testing. If all goes well, Kuttner and his crew could collect $5 million in prize money. If not, they might still profit, should automakers turn to lighter vehicles and find Edison 2 holds the patents to technologies that could speed their time to the showroom. For NPR News, I'm Sandy Houseman.
And you can see pictures of this and all the other concept cars on NPR.org.
There's apparently another type of foul play at work in the food world, olive oil fraud. A new study from the University of California at Davis claims more than two-thirds of random samples of imported extra virgin olive oil don't meet the extra virgin standard. From Capital Public Radio, Elaine Korn reports.
The Olive Oil Chemistry Lab is on the Davis campus. It overlooks many of the campus's 2,000 olive trees. Managing the lab's olive oil forensics is chemist Charles Shoemaker.
We have our own CSI olive oil lab here.
To be extra virgin, it can't be rancid, adulterated with cheap refined olive oil, or doctored up, cut, with lesser oils. Shoemaker wasn't all that surprised that many of the 14 major brands tested failed certain tests.
It's become a very sophisticated practice, the adulteration of olive oil throughout the world.
The lab says it can prove defects, degradation, and dilution in olive oil beyond what human taste buds can figure out. Shoemaker zeroes in on specific flaws.
We do spectroscopic studies looking for oxidation.
That means the oil's old or rancid. Shoemaker also tests fatty acids.
To make sure the oil is all from olives and not from soybean, sunflower, or other types of oils.
No molecule can hide. Shoemaker revs up a small vacuum. It removes solvents and isolates chlorophyll, which is always an oil made from green olives, but never in lesser-grade seed oil. As it sucks a sample, he's patient.
It takes about 25 minutes per sample to do just this one step.
The UC Davis study was funded in part by the California Olive Oil Council. Oils were tested by some methods not yet recognized by international standards, and for that reason, Bob Bauer of the North American Olive Oil Association, which represents importers, disputes the Davis study.
It's irresponsible to create the misperception that they've done based on unrecognized tests. These results directly contradict our 20 years of more extensive sampling and what those results show.
There's never been a legal definition in the U.S. for any grade of olive oil. Mounting concern over truth in olive oil labeling has drawn in the USDA. New American regulations will conform to international standards. Olive oil from every olive oil producing country, including America, will be subject to random sampling off retail shelves starting in October using a lab in Georgia. For NPR News, I'm Elaine Korn in Sacramento.
This is NPR News.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, we continue our series Tell Me Mobile. New research shows minorities are outpacing white users when it comes to handheld devices and those data applications for those devices. Earlier in the week, we talked about how this phenomenon might be closing the digital divide, but in a few minutes, we'll ask if there is a downside to this. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we wanted to talk a bit more about the issues raised by the Shirley Sherrod story. Specifically, we wanted to talk about issues of technology and journalism and ethics. Just to recap, in less than 24 hours, Shirley Sherrod has gone from being publicly vilified as a racist, pressured to quit her job at the Department of Agriculture, to being offered her job back and apologized to, all because of a long speech that was edited and placed on YouTube by a conservative activist with a record of playing a role in provocative media stunts. We wanted to talk more about what the arc of this story says about the current media environment and specifically what role social media may play in that. So we've called our own Andy Carvin. He's a senior strategist with NPR. He runs our social media desk. He's here with me in our Washington, D.C. studio. Also with us is Richard Prince. He's a veteran journalist and media critic and author of Journalisms. That's an online publication about diversity issues in the media. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
So, Richard, let me start with you. I want to get a quick reaction from each of you. What do you think this story is about? Howie Kurtz of the Washington Post, who covers the media, wrote this morning that Shirley Sherrod might be the only official ever dismissed because of the fear of being denounced by Glenn Beck. That's, of course, the Fox News talk show host who's campaigned against other White House employees and famously called President Obama a racist. But I want to ask you, is this fear of Glenn Beck or is this story about something else?
Well, one of the things it is about is fear of Glenn Beck and the kind of opinion mongering that he represents, and the fact that the media and the administration are on the defensive against this kind of thing. I believe that this represents a danger to traditional journalism as truth tellers, and that the public needs to, instead of cheering Glenn Beck, cheer calls to get to the bottom of things and to tell the truth.
Well, some people might argue that this was a victory for that kind of truth telling because when the fuller story became clear, the situation was addressed rather quickly. So, Richard, very
right.
quickly,
when
some people might argue this is an object lesson of the other, which is why traditional media methods, checking context and all that, really do matter and are vindicated.
That's true if it had happened earlier. But in the meantime, as I remember that during the Reagan administration, the Secretary of Labor, Ray Donovan, was the victim of the AbScam case. And he said when it was all over, where do I go to get my reputation back? The vindication didn't happen soon enough. It should have happened before anything ever aired.
Andy Carvin, what about you? Is this about the power of YouTube? I mean, this isn't the first video piece that's appeared on YouTube that can cause the significant reaction. Andrew Breitbart, who posted this edited video of Shirley Sherrod, was earlier involved in this other incident where these two activists dressed up as what they said were a pimp and a prostitute in order to discredit the group Acorn, and really did succeed in causing serious damage to that organization. So is this about YouTube or is this about something else?
I think it's less about YouTube because this could have been put on any number of platforms. I think it's more about our collective complacency that when it was posted, many people jumped on the story and didn't bother to ask questions about its ultimate context. Given the way our 24-hour news cycle works and how social media in some ways speeds it up even more so, we don't always step back to take a moment and think, what exactly is going on here? Is there more to it? Is it solely a 2.5-minute video, or was there a larger context in which a greater meaning might be lost in this current situation?
And who is it, you're saying, who is it, in your view, who lacks this context? Is it the, I mean, when this story was originally picked up by the so-called mainstream media, for example, the Washington Post website, Ed O'Keefe, or ABC News, Ed O'Keefe on his blog, it was after the NAACP had already denounced her and the Agriculture Department, her employers, were already denouncing her.
Well, I think it was a number of players taking place here. NAACP probably should have been a lot faster at getting the full video out, or at least putting out a statement saying that there's much more to this situation, and as soon as we can post the video, we can. But at the same time, if you're a blogger or working at a news organization and you have this clip and you see that it's fairly tightly edited, even though it has long portions of unedited speech in it, it's still, we're looking at about 2 minutes of video here. And chances are you could take a guess that her presentation at this event was longer than a 2 or 3 minute speech. And so so as a reporter, as an editor, you should still have that healthy skepticism and ask yourself and ask your colleagues what else is going on here. And so the story had taken on a life of its own because she clearly was in trouble.
Well, they were trying to get ahead of the story. All these institutions are trying to get ahead of the
exactly,
story.
Exactly, because given how these stories take on a life of their own online and as well on talk radio and other media platforms, sometimes it didn't feel necessary for them to dig a little deeper into what's going on here. And so that opportunity was lost.
Andy, I'm going to ask you this, and Richard, I'm going to ask you this to follow up on this. There's a growing discussion within the online community about whether some standards need to be imposed. I mean, earlier there have been conversations about sponsorship, like corporate sponsorship, and whether you need to be more transparent about saying that I was given this tube of lipstick before I reviewed it. I'm giving these things for free, things of that sort. And I wondered, is there any online discussion going on about standards in presenting information along these lines? Because it's very clear that this information, you know, was edited, and clearly Andrew Breitbart didn't seem to feel any responsibility to present the broader context. But he's not a journalist. He's an activist. He's a provocateur. He's advancing a side. Is there any conversation about standards online?
I don't think there's a serious conversation simply because this isn't really that different than if you look at political ads during campaigns where opponents will selectively take bits of information to put their adversary in the worst possible light. It's all rhetorical strategy. That's what's going on here. When it comes to bloggers, this and anyone else online for that matter, this is really a free speech issue, and you have just as much of a right to use rhetorical arguments, even ones that are somewhat questionable, to support your own side.
Richard, do you think race plays a role in this? I mean, if the subject were something else, not a racially charged conversation, do you think that the same effect would have been had? If it was gender or some other topic, what do you think race? What role do you think race plays in the way this whole thing ensued?
Well, I think race is is a big part of this, of course, but from the journalism angle, I think race and diversity play a role. One of the things that's happening in our media right now is this transformation to the internet means we're losing a lot of the old veterans who say this just doesn't smell right. You have younger people. You have people who you don't have enough of a diversity of people who can use their own experiences to judge the worth of a story, the truth of a story. If I can just take a point of personal privilege here now, the last time I was on, the last time I was on here, we were talking about Helen Thomas, who was the White House columnist who said Israelis should get the hell out of Palestine. And we were all wondering, how could she say such a thing? And everyone denounced it and said, what a shame. Well, after that, I talked with her family and some Arab Americans who said that when she said Palestine, she was not talking about the 1947 Palestine. She was talking about Palestine as it exists now, which is the West Bank and Gaza, and the people who are going into those settlements. Well, that interpretation of what she meant was not transmitted through the media because there are not enough people who have that understanding of where those folks are coming from.
I see.
And I had the heck of a time trying to get people to even acknowledge that there was another side to this.
I see. We're going to have to leave it there. There's clearly more to talk about, and so I thank you for that. Richard Prince is a veteran journalist and media critic. As we know, time is one thing they're not making any more of. He's the author of Journalisms. That's an online publication about diversity issues in the media. He joined us from member station WETA in Virginia. Andy Carvin follows all things social media here at NPR. He's our senior strategist. He was here with me in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thank you both.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Today we continue our series Tell Me Mobile. Despite the general assumption that minority communities are not keeping pace with new digital innovations for whatever reason, ethnicity, relatability, or just the money to buy stuff, it turns out that young Latino and African Americans are using mobile devices and their varied applications more than any other group. Yesterday, we looked at some of the reasons behind this trend with two digital thinkers, both men, Smokey Fontaine of Interactive One and Mark Lopez of Terra Networks USA. Both made the case that this intense involvement with the mobile space has the potential to go a long way toward bridging the digital divide. It is worth noting that both men work at companies that provide content tailored to Black and Latino users. If you want to hear that conversation, please just go to our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More. Today, though, we wanted to ask if there are drawbacks to this phenomenon of widespread mobile use. Craig Watkins has spent over 10 years studying young people's digital behavior. He's an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and he joins us now from member station KUT in Austin. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, Professor, you wrote a book titled The Young and the Digital, What the Migration to Social Network Sites, Games, and Anytime, Anywhere Media Means for Our Future. So the first thing I wanted to ask is just what's your general sense of particularly the subject we're focusing on, the intense interest that young African-Americans and Latinos have with mobile devices? Why do you think that they use these devices more than other groups?
I think one of the main reasons has to do with, you know, the fact that Black and Latino youth are more likely to live in households where broadband internet is not available. So the kinds of things that they want to do online, which are typically, you know, watching videos, playing games, if you don't have access to broadband, it becomes virtually impossible to do those kinds of things. So the mobile has become a kind of alternative gateway to those kinds of activities. Another reason, I think, has to do with the fact that Black and Latino youth oftentimes live in spaces and environments where their access to technology is either limited or kind of surveilled in ways that make them uncomfortable. And so the mobile device gives them more privacy, gives them more control over what they like to do with their internet lives.
Yesterday, our two guests made the point that this intense involvement is overall a positive thing because it gets kids to understand that the technology is theirs, it belongs to them, that they have ownership of it, it's not something that's for other people, and that that can then lead to an interest in, you know, engineering, technology, computers, and so forth. So they made the case for the positive side of it. Let's talk about the other side of it. Do you think that there's a negative side to this intense involvement with these devices?
I think there is. And more specifically, I think there are certain consequences that we certainly need to be aware of and able to address. And so one of the negative things that has to be considered is, you know, how are young Black and Latinos using their mobile devices? Are they using them primarily, and much of the data suggests that they are, using them primarily to interact with their friends, to listen to music, to play games. And while those activities are certainly, you know, viable and can be argued as important, it doesn't necessarily suggest that they are using their access to the internet via their mobile devices for social, educational, or civic-related kinds of matters.
But is there any sense that the white kids are using them for those purposes either?
You know, white youth do have access to other ways of getting to the internet. In other words, they're not simply restricted to their mobile devices. And given that the mobile device is something that's considered more personal, something more social, something more entertainment driven, when you don't have access to other means of the internet, other means of the sort of digital media environment, I think it does create limited opportunities for Black and Latino youth who are going online primarily via their mobile device. And if I could maybe make one other point, I think what's also happening is that Black and Latino youth are going online at a time where if they're living in households without laptops, without computers, that oftentimes means that maybe their parents or their guardians aren't as active online as they possibly could be. So what you see is a kind of generational disconnect within Black and Latino youth households where they aren't necessarily getting the guidance, where they aren't necessarily able to have conversations or meaningful conversations with their parents or guardians about what's happening on Facebook, about the kinds of images, about the kinds of messages that friends are sharing with each other. And I think those kinds of conversations, that lack of guidance, that lack of mentoring, is something that I think is quite crucial in young people's digital lives and how they navigate these experiences.
I think what you're talking about is the fact that you can relatively easily monitor or limit access to certain websites or cable television channels on a family device like a television set or a home computer that's sitting in the kitchen or sitting in the den, okay? Whereas it's very hard to monitor the websites that kids access on their mobile devices. It's very hard to monitor their access to social media sites if they're using personal devices.
Absolutely. And that, let's be frank, that's one of the appeals of the mobile to teens, right, is that it provides, again, that kind of autonomy, that kind of privacy, that kind of control over the media and information that they access. But the other thing that I think I'm trying to allude to is we're beginning to understand that even though young people have sort of led the way in some respects when it comes to texting, have led the way in some respects when it comes to social network sites like Facebook, that there still is a reason to believe that parents and that adults in their lives are important for helping them to navigate some of the ethical issues that they may encounter online. So let's say, for example, and we came across this in our research, you know, a young woman at her high school who's being sort of bullied around by her friends online. She lives in a household, right, where her parents have no clue of what's happening, have no idea what Facebook is, have no idea what she's doing online. And so they are completely incapable of helping her negotiate and navigate that situation. And it turned out to be a pretty dramatic and profound experience for her, which in some respects could have been dealt with if she lived in a household or lived in an environment where she could at least have basic conversations about what was happening in her digital life.
Is that, though, more of a concern for minority youth than it is for youth from other backgrounds? Because, frankly, the cases that have come to our attention that have resulted in some seriously tragic consequences, none of those cases to this point have involved minority youth, interestingly enough.
These issues in no way are sort of unique to Black and Latino youth. And in fact, you can make a case that some of these issues are quite pronounced in other communities in some respects. And so, again, it's not that that these activities or behaviors are unique to them. But I do think when we consider the environment out of which Black and Latino youth are participating in these kinds of activities, not all environments are equal, right? In other words, what we found is that in sort of Black and Latino communities and Black and Latino schools, that these kinds of opportunities for engaging with these issues are quite rare. In other words, not only are children and students not having access to these kinds of conversational opportunities, it's rare that parents have access to these opportunities as well. And what it does is it diminishes, the capabilities of the larger environment to be a kind of supporting and nurturing environment that helps kids manage these issues much more efficiently, or at least potentially much more efficiently.
Craig Watkins is an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of The Young and the Digital, among other books. He joined us from member station KUT in Austin, Texas. Professor Watkins, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
And now to finish up the week, it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with me as usual. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Michelle. Well, as we heard earlier in this program with the Barbershop Guys, and as we're hearing everywhere, lots of folks are still buzzing about Shirley Sherrod. Now, she's the former USDA official who was forced to resign this week after comments about overcoming racial prejudice were taken out of context. Now, just in case you haven't heard this, here's a clip from her speech back in March to an NAACP group in Georgia.
When I made that commitment, I was making that commitment to Black people. And to Black people only. But you know, God will show you things, and he'll put things in your path so that you realize that the struggle is really about poor people.
Lee, yesterday on the blog, I asked folks to weigh in on what really made this story ignite the way it did. And I, you know, asked the question of whether maybe this has something to do with the tricky ethics of a YouTube generation. Well, here's an email we received from listener Robert. He writes, I think you should be asking how the White House could be put in the position of being on the defensive when there was, in actuality, nothing to be defensive about. They should have come down on the person who perpetuated this fraud with all the power of the presidential office. Robert goes on to say, it seems that the president is always on the defensive instead of demanding the respect of his office. He really needs to kick some butt, and this is a good time to start.
All right. Thanks, Robert. And maybe you should apply for a job over there at the White House. There may be a vacancy soon if maybe this isn't cleared up the way it should be. All right. Well, Michelle, you wrote a commentary this week focusing on another hot topic, immigration. And you actually compared it to a recent earthquake in the D.C. area, suggesting it is the political earthquake of our time. And you challenged what some call the conventional wisdom about illegal immigration in this country.
What we hear most, both from the public and from so-called leaders who should know better, is the fear about excessive crimes, about degraded public services, about the deterioration of the culture. The objective data shows that many of these complaints have no basis in fact at all, that immigrants do not commit a disproportionate number of crimes, that they do pay taxes, and that they do, in fact, for the most part, want to learn English and participate in the culture if given the chance.
And in response to that, we heard this from someone who blogs under the name, believe it or not, Wolfpack, who writes, quote, I like immigrants. They add some fresh flavor to this country. I just have issues with our letting anybody in and eventually giving them amnesty. We need to control how many people enter this country yearly and what type of person we let in.
Okay, Wolfpack, thanks for your comment. And thanks for all those who wrote in on this topic. It's obviously a topic that concerns a lot of people. Lee, we had a second conversation about research that says some adults become unhappy after having children. Last week, we checked in with our regular panel of moms. This week, we asked a group of dads to weigh in. Here's blogger and new father, Paul Fidalgo.
Well, my happiness is doing just fine, actually. And I would say that I'm happier with my boy around. He's 7 months old now. His name is Toby. And he's our first kid. And it has actually been a major transformation. And I don't mean to be Pollyanna-ish about this, but it really was kind of like a gene turned on. And there were new levels of happiness that I had not experienced before.
Well, not everybody was feeling the same way. We later had this note posted to our website by blogger Victoria. She writes, great for him, but duh, babies, especially just one with no other children around, are nothing but cute. Have him check back in a couple of years during those toddler years. The first baby honeymoon period is not comparable to having children once they can talk back to you. Love my kids, but can say most of the time I'm too busy or tired to think about being happy. Okay, Victoria, thanks for keeping it real. Lee, what else?
Well, finally, Michelle, we asked listeners to join us in presenting Tell Me Mobile. And we produced this series this week on air and online, and it focused on distinct trends among users of mobile technology, and more specifically, how many techies are accessing the web more on their cell phones than on an actual desktop or laptop computer. Now, listeners hit us up on Facebook to tell us whether they could relate to all of this, and they told us about their favorite apps as well. We heard this from our Facebook friend, Lynn.
Having my mobile phone has made it very easy to pop on, glance at email or Facebook, and get back to real life. I think I spend less time on my laptop because I'm not tempted to lazily browse. I just grab and go. As for apps, my husband just installed a weather station in our backyard so I can pop onto WeatherBug and see the weather at home, even from work 30 miles away. I won't say I can't live without it, but doggone it, it's cool.
That does sound cool. Thank you, Lynn. And thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
Time now for our video pick of the week. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor, is here. And I'm looking on my paper. It says RoboFish.
That's right, Ira.
Robofish.
Robofish.
Dun, 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 dun. Not a shark.
We're bringing Jaws in every week, right?
It's Shark Week, Shark Month on Science.
It's always Shark Week on Science Friday.
Tell us about what Robofish is.
Yeah, it's an unusual robot. It's a fish about the size of your hand, and it's designed to swim with the fishes. This is a robot that's made.
It's a different movie.
So the designer is Maurizio Porfirian. Right. He's an engineer at NYU Poly here in New York. Mm-hmm. And he studies movement, basically, using math. And so he's looked at fish schooling and tried to understand how fish school by making these complex mathematical models. And then he takes those sophisticated models and tries to turn them into, you know, devices, objects. Right. So he made this little robotic fish. And here's the most amazing part of the story. So he makes this little robotic fish, and you can see it on the website swimming around. And on his birthday, they stick it in the lab swimming pool in the tank, and they put in some golden shiners. And this was just sort of for fun. And they noticed something kind of surprising happening, which was that when they put the robot in and turned it on, it's remote controlled, the little fish started sort of milling about the robot, and they even followed it around the tank.
Like it's litter? Like a school of fish following the robo-fish around?
Following the robo-leader. Now they're, you know,
and they didn't expect that.
They didn't really
know. They just
know.
Did it as a prank, and they learned something.
I mean, I don't know if it was a prank or not. I mean, the idea is to build robots that are biomimetic, right, that are like fish. But I think the what's different about this research is that they build this biomimetic robot, and then they put it back in with the biological system and saw what happened. And they're not biologists, so they're not making any great claims that this is, they understand what makes a fish a leader.
A bunch of engineers building a robot.
But they did say, well, you know, we did notice this sort of strange thing happening, which is that, you know, some percentage of the time the fish will follow it around.
And you can see that. It's very fascinating. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com, our video pick of the week up there in the left corner. And you just click on this video, and there's a little fish coming, and the robot, and the fish are following it around. It's almost like they're imprinting that on the robot.
It's a little creepy I think there's something sort of surprising about it. But I think what they're going to keep doing is building sort of different versions of this robot to try to understand what about it makes it attractive to the fish that they're working with.
I guess they should bring some fishologists in, or, you know.
Yeah, I think they that eventually the idea will be to collaborate with people who know a lot about fish behavior.
And did they have just one robot fish?
Or no, they have several, actually. Yeah. They just developed a new one, which is a little bit noisier. It can move faster. It's built for more challenging terrain than the lab swimming pool. So the idea is that they have
upstream, it's going to be able to
take fish away from the dam. I mean, the idea is actually that maybe you could use robotic fish to lead fish away from dangers, like an oil spill, for example.
Or into the open net of a fisherman.
You know, they didn't mention that, but that's right. This could be a boon for fishing. It's sort of a remote control lure. Come to me.
All right. Now we've got the commercial side of this figured out. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Flora Lichtman, the video pick of the week. It's RoboFish up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. It's a great little video, and it's kind of interesting to see how these engineers came up with this fish that actually acts more like a fish than they thought it would. Our program producers include Christopher Intagliata, senior producer, Annette Heist, Charles Berquist is our director, Flora is our multimedia editor, Lashu Bayek is our Spanish language producer, Neil Rausch is our technical director, and Manoli Weatherall is at the controls here in New York. Our science and arts producer is Catherine Wells. If you missed any part of the program, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can log on and get our podcasts, and the video pick of the week is up there. And you know, you can take it along with you on your iPhone. We have an iPhone app that you can take the video and the audio, and so you can take them with you. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.